This episode is going to be part two of the White House Farm Murders, one of the most notorious murder cases in the history of England. If you didn't listen to part one, I urge you to do that now and check out part two, as we're going to get into exactly who did commit this atrocity.
Hi, and welcome to the Weird World Podcast. I'm Carrie.
I'm Dean.
And you going to give us a quick little recap, Dean?
A little quick recap. So for part one, we talked about the White House Farm Murders. Hopefully you just listened to it and you're binging and listening to part two right now. Hopefully you weren't too bummed out by the horrific events that occurred on August 7th, 1985.
I was bummed out by it.
It was pretty horrible. It's hard to listen to, but it is a pretty remarkable case, and there are going to be some kind of twists and turns. We learned about the background of the family, most specifically the parents, their daughter Sheila, who's adopted, their other adopted son Jeremy. We learned and essentially the allegation was, and the initial impression from the police, in fact, what they thought all the evidence pointed to, was that Sheila, who had serious mental instability and had been diagnosed in a variety of things, but including things like psychoactive disorder and psychosis, she appeared to be the murder-suicide in the case, and that adopted son, her brother Jeremy, who had not been there at the time and who alerted the police that something bad was going on back at his parents' house, was a victim almost as much as the rest of the family was. At that point, though, the relations, the boot flowers, got involved, and they began to suspect Jeremy. Now, they were related to the family through the mother, June.
Right.
Her sister Pamela had married Robert Bootflower and had produced some kids, and they were the cousins of Jeremy and Sheila's.
Assuming June was the oldest kid.
Was she older than Pamela? I think she was.
Yeah, because that's why she got the farm.
Presumably.
Okay. Yeah.
So she got she got this thriving White House farm, a 300-acre farm that's very profitable, and the family shared. We'll talk about this in a little bit, but they had some other possessions as well, some significant possessions.
Okay.
And they're pretty wealthy. And so the Bootflowers went to the police and tried to sort of drum up a lot of suspicion and get them to pursue Jeremy. And parts of the police force, of the Essex police, believed them and were on her side, and also were highly suspicious of Jeremy. Thought Jeremy might have actually been the murderer. And they spun a whole story of how they imagined that he had done it, taking his mom's bicycle, riding these byways and little farm roads in the middle of the wee hours of the morning, murdering his family and getting back on his bicycle after escaping or exiting through a window to make it look like the entire house was locked from the inside, and had essentially framed Sheila for committing these murders and then committing suicide.
Yeah, I have thoughts on that too. I better start taking some notes.
You should probably take some notes. Yeah, maybe you should even set up a timeline, Carrie. I don't know.
I need a timeline.
Yeah, everyone needs a timeline. We all need timelines for everything all the time, always. So this is my fear. We talked about the investigation, and then we got into the suspicions and the story from the Bootflowers. What happened ultimately, though, was that the Bootflowers were able to get a review of the case by higher authorities above the lead detective, who thought they were full of shit. And those higher authorities reviewed the case and came to the conclusion that indeed Sheila had committed the murders and then killed herself. So the Bootflowers seemed like their attempt had failed, and Jeremy was going to inherit everything from his parents' fortune. But let's see, because someone we've talked about here a couple of times is Julia Mugford. Remember her?
Mm-hmm.
She was the girlfriend of Jeremy Bamber.
Yep.
And on September 7th, 1985, 1 month after the murders, Julia Mugford went into the local police station and she told them she had a stunning story to tell.
Mm.
She was 21 years old. She was a student teacher. She'd met Jeremy while working at a pizza place with the weird name of Sloppy Joe's.
Oh.
I don't know if England, I looked up, I don't think England has Sloppy Joe's. Like, we have Sloppy Joe's, which is, to their great shame, you need to try a man, which they are delicious. They're lost. You're lost, England, if you don't have Sloppy Joe's. I don't think you do. Sloppy Joe's is ground beef with this delicious ketchup-y
sauce.
Kind of sauce to it. And you eat it like a hamburger, but it's better. So I don't know why it was called Sloppy Joe's. Probably something completely nothing to do with the man witch.
No, I'm going to make some sloppy joes.
Okay. I'll eat them.
Okay. No, you won't.
I like sloppy joes. I'll make myself eat them. I don't do a lot of red meat. Detective Stan Jones, who you recall from part one, was already pretty much sold on Jeremy's guilt. He interviewed Julia Mugford. He went so far as to take her into protective custody, which, intentional or not, implied that she was in danger from Jeremy for what she was saying.
Well, I guess she might be, but did she announce to Jeremy she was going to go to the police department? And
I'm sure she didn't, but they probably assumed Jeremy's going to find out very soon. And after he found out what she was saying, she could be in danger.
Huh.
What she had to say was pretty damning. So Julia Mugford alleged that Jeremy had been planning on murdering his family for over 1 year.
Okay. Quote, well, this isn't going to make her look very good either.
Not really now.
If she knew about it that long.
Quote, he said he would like to commit the perfect murder. And she said Jeremy had told her this. In October of 1984, so that's not quite a year, but well before the August 1985 murders, Julia said that Jeremy had said he wanted, quote, to get rid of them all. And the motive, she said, was obvious. Quote, all Jeremy wanted was money, which was more or less what the bootflyers were saying as well to the police at this time. And of course, Jeremy had the perfect patsy, his sister, with this long history of pretty significant mental illness. It was it was perfect. He would set everything up to frame Sheila. He would put the rifle in her hands after killing her. He would lock all the doors from the inside and then get out the kitchen window and ride off on his mother's bicycle. That story sounds familiar. It's because it is, but that's what she told the police. Julia claimed she got upset when he had first told her this, and she started crying, and so he didn't bring it up again. If that sounds convenient, it's because it is as well. But she obviously did nothing about it. Though she had this dreadful knowledge that her boyfriend was planning on killing her husband. Now, if you want to be fair to her, you say, I don't know if she told the police that I didn't take him seriously, but you could argue that she didn't think he's really going to act.
Of course. Yes. Yeah.
But.
Or like he wasn't specific. He didn't tell her when
it's going to be worse for her.
Okay.
He didn't mention it again, she said, for a very long time until the actual day of the deed.
No.
Or actually, I guess technically the day before. Jeremy called Julia at 9:50 at night. Remember, he supposedly left his parents' house at 9:30. He got home, which was just about 3+ miles away. He called Julia at 9:50 that night, and he was very upset. She claimed that he said, quote, the crime will have to be tonight or never. So
why?
He's going back. I don't know. She didn't say.
Wait, did she say, was his plan always to kill the children too?
Everybody, because he wanted everything. So if the children were alive, then they would inherit effectively Sheila's portion of June and Neville's fortune. So he would share it with his nephews if he let them live.
Okay.
So he planned on killing everybody. And maybe it was, I don't know how long, many more days before they were due to get picked up by their father to go to Norway. The kids were anyway. So this was the perfect time. Everybody was in the same house,
so
very close to his.
So that makes sense why it has to be tonight.
Timing-wise, it does. Yeah. Or very, very soon. He had made that 3 or so in the morning call from the farmhouse to Julia, as you recall from part one. And she had told the police that, and so had Jeremy. But Sheila said the call had been at about 3:30 a.m., not 3 a.m. That may or may not mean anything, but her roommate, she lived with a roommate, said, no, it was more like 3. But anyway, at this call, this early morning call, Jeremy had told her, quote, everything is going well. Something is wrong at the farm. I haven't had any sleep all night. Bye, honey, and love you lots, end quote. Very confusing.
Yeah.
If he's from the farm, murdering or having just murdered his parents and everyone else in that house, that's a very strange thing. If he's at his cottage still, that's kind of weird. Why she said this, I think I'll tell you just in 1 minute. But it is still a very strange call to have said.
I mean,
that
sounds
said
pre-murder.
It does, doesn't it? Or it sounds like during the process. I'll tell you why that made sense within her story in just a second. Julia said that she'd been really drowsy, which is, sometime at 3 in the morning, 3:30 in the morning. So she didn't really understand the implications of what Jeremy is telling her, which I find hard to believe. Though, kind of what she said Jeremy said does seem incoherent. She told the police she only later realized Jeremy was telling her he had slaughtered his entire family, or that he had had that done. that 3
But he'd already told her it was going to be that night.
It's going to be that night, yeah.
Okay.
I know.
So,
and it was now early the morning of, exactly. Yeah. And she still, and she goes back to sleep.
Yeah.
So, wow. Yeah. Later, she said that Jeremy called her and told Julia that Sheila had run amok and the police were on their way and would pick her, Julia, up to take her to the farmhouse, which more or less jives with what Jeremy had said to the police as well. I know why Julia needs to be there. I don't know. I need my girlfriend here to comfort me. Remember, at this point, they were going to be waiting outside the house for a very long time with the police. Once there, once Julia had been dropped off at the farmhouse by the police, Jeremy had, Julia said, taken her aside and smirked and, quote, "I should have been an actor," end quote.
Huh.
Jeremy had revealed the details of his deed over the next few days to Julia, she told the police.
Uh-huh.
He told her how he had tried to prepare for his brutality of what he was going to do by strangling rats with his bare hands. So I'm going to kill my family.
Yeah.
He must have known he was going to use a rifle, but he prepared, hardened himself, I guess.
Yeah.
By killing rats.
Okay.
Apparently he was not a very strong rat strangler, though, because in the end, he decided to hire a hitman instead of committing the murders himself. So that's why that call maybe makes a little more sense. If he's saying it's going well, that sort of implies he is in communication with the hitman at the farmhouse. He's at his cottage. Remember, we have no idea where these calls or if these calls were made or where they came from, because the British Telecom didn't keep these records at the time.
Yeah.
So that seems to make more sense. Her story now says he didn't do it. A hitman did. Julia named the hitman to the police. I cannot find his name in any of the sources I read. I even tried to Google, what was the name of the supposed hitman? You can't find it. All we know is he was a local plumber. And so apparently unclogging pipes is a far better experience for committing mass murder than rat strangling, because he had agreed to do this. Jeremy was going to pay him £20,000, which is now over $8,000. The plumber was supposed to call Jeremy from the White House when he had completed his work. So that's the implication of that earlier, that supposed phone call.
Wait, how much was he going to pay him?
£2,000. I'm sorry. Okay. £2,000.
Okay.
About $8,000 in current American money. Julia said that Jeremy said the plumber had pulled it off perfectly. The only hitch was Neville had put up a fight and that the plumber had got really mad and shot him a bunch more times than he initially was going to shoot him. The plumber had saved Sheila for the last, making her lie down and shoot herself on the floor of her parents' bedroom. It was the plumber who put the Bible on her chest, and presumably under direction of Jeremy, just to kind of make her look a little crazier, like she's going through a psychotic episode, and this would explain why she had done what they wanted the police to believe she had done. The lead detective, Taft Jones, was called away from dinner at his golf club after Stan Jones had taken this story from Julia Mugford. And he just got the word, "Hey, you're needed at the station immediately," and he's pissed off. When he got there, he said, "This had better be fucking good." Then he was told, and his world kind of collapsed.
Yeah.
He was devastated. Remember, he had poo-pooed it. He had already been told this theory from the boot flyers and kicked him out of his office. He was just crestfallen. He was shocked by this.
Completely believe her story? I don't believe the hitman part.
We'll see.
Okay.
Did the police believe her story?
Yeah.
Most of them did.
Yeah.
So the case that the boot flyers had presented to him was now being pretty much perfectly corroborated by Jeremy's girlfriend, who said she effectively had firsthand knowledge of him telling her this.
That part's a little suspicious, too.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
She basically backed up the entire story as fashioned by the boot flyers and their allies, like Detective Stan Jones. A person in the room said, quote, "Taft's face went from red to white in a split second." So he was just like, "Oh, my God, I've been so wrong. I can't believe what's happening here." Taft Jones went to London the next day to fetch Jeremy, who was staying at his sister's home in Maidvale. And it was early in the morning. They woke him up with the words, "I'm arresting you on suspicion of murdering your mother, father, sister, and her two children." So he opens the door, and that's what they say to him.
Yeah.
They cuff him. They lead him away. They take him back to Essex. Jeremy was absolutely in complete shock. He literally told Jones that he didn't understand what was happening. He couldn't believe it. He said, quote, "It must be something else you want me for, not murder," end quote. We'll see what that was. There is something that he did that he probably thought they were arresting for, but when he couldn't process the idea that they were arresting for the murder. In fact, I'll go ahead and spoil it. He probably thought they're arresting him for the burglary of that property that his parents owned of the £1,000.
In
part one. We'll find out later that he did indeed do that. Jeremy naturally said Julia is lying about everything. When he was told what had happened and why he was arrested, he said, well, she's lying. And he knew what her motive was. He had broken up with her very recently. It had always been a rough relationship, and it had been even more frayed recently. Julia even had tried to smother Jeremy with a pillow.
According to Jeremy. And he's so great that any woman would...
Carrie.
Go to these lengths.
He was a dashing
to
young
get
man.
Back at.
That's what he's saying. He's saying basically she's trying to get back at me because I broke up with her. I broke it off. Okay. And Jeremy was admittedly a bit of a cad, though. He admitted during one other fight that he erupted that he had got a call from a woman and was like carrying on the phone with Julia sitting right next to him at their house. He admitted to doing that. And she had realized what he was doing and who he was talking to. And she flew into a rage and smashed a mirror and slapped Jeremy and then twisted. And then he was calmed her down by twisting her arm behind her back. So he's kind of, he's saying these things, which again, don't make him look great, but he's saying she was very high strung.
Yeah.
We had a bad relationship. I broke up with her. That's why she's lying.
So he's saying he broke up with her after the murder
just 3 days ago.
Okay.
From when she went and told the story.
Okay.
And went to the police. He said she's vindictive. She was kind of a schemer. He thought it's likely she'd be vengeful. So it's like this is so Julia.
Yeah.
I'm telling you she's lying. Don't believe her.
Yeah.
But Jeremy was a little bit of a schemer too, because that night he's in the prison cell. He knows this allegation from Julia is very serious. They've arrested him for murder because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, he must have known that Bootflower's story hadn't worked, but Julia's story had gotten him arrested for murder. So he's probably very fearful at this point. And he writes a little note in his cell, and he asked a police officer there, he said, will you get this to Julia? The note said, thinking about you, sorry for splitting up. I love you! !! And he signed the note with his cute little pet name that Julia called him, Stinko.
Nice.
He's desperately trying to get back on her good side, hoping,
She'll
have to imagine,
back.
She will just recant everything. Exactly. So knowing they would be looking into her past, though, Julia did kind of come clean.
Uh-huh.
She knew there was going to be some things that were not going to look great. One of those things were that she had not, a few months ago, stolen a friend's checkbook. I think late the previous year. So some months ago, she stole a friend's checkbook. And that she wrote bad checks worth about £700 on her French checks and cashed them in various places and got a lot of, commodities, stuff like that. Which, again, would have been a few thousand dollars American money. So, she said, I helped the friend pay back these things. So like, see, it's okay. No, don't worry about it. But still, it didn't look good. And she knew that. So she told the police about that. So she says, look, I made that right. I'm sorry I did it. Otherwise, I'm a totally, I almost forgot. Yes, I did help Jeremy burgle his family's caravan park for £1,000 that had been stolen in March. So she had to admit to that.
Yeah.
That she and Jeremy had indeed done that deed. So besides that, though, my record is spotless. You can believe every word I say, as far as you know. The authorities, in fact, did pretty much believe every word they said, and they effectively prepared to prosecute Jeremy Bamber for mass murder.
Yeah.
So while lead detective Taft Jones had made the arrest of Jeremy, he actually privately still had a little bit of doubt. He wasn't completely sold. Police, though, really needed this case closed. This is an incredibly notorious case. It's the biggest case in England right now, let alone Essex. And
how long after the murders are we at now?
When she came to the police, about a month. So
just
a little bit more than a month. They arrest Jeremy. They have him in jail.
And they hadn't done any sort of search of his house because they wouldn't have had any reason to.
They'd been in the back and around the house. Remember, he had found his mom's bicycle leaned against the wall at Jeremy's cottage, Stan Jones had. So they had been outside without any kind of probable cause or any kind of warrant. But they now are going to be able to do that, yes.
Yeah, but presumably.
Yeah.
Unless he's an idiot, he's taking care of it.
For sure. It's been over a month.
Yeah.
But the Essex police really wanted this case closed, so they sidelined Taft Jones at this point, and they bring in Stan Jones to essentially, hey, go get a confession from Jeremy. So Stan Jones interviews Jeremy, and it's pretty antagonistic. At one point, Stan Jones told the stenographer to note that, quote, the accused is continually staring at me. But Jeremy is just, so Jeremy's, you know, remember, he's arrogant, but he has to be fearful, but he's still in his mind, I know I didn't do this. So he's fairly confident, and he just repeatedly denies any involvement whatsoever. Stan Jones can get nothing approaching a confession out of Jeremy. The detective did get Jimmy to admit, though, that the kitchen window could be jimmied and made to look like it was locked from the outside, and that he had known this since he was a teen. I think he had sort of exited the house back in his wayward years. He also got him to admit that he had been behind the Osea Road Vacation Park robbery. So he got him to admit a couple things.
Yeah.
But again, nothing remotely like the murder. He absolutely steadfastly said, I did not do anything. That was Sheila. So this meant that their star witness could be implicated in that crime, in addition to the series of check frauds. So that wasn't great. And then the case took another hit when the hitman plumber that Julia Mugford had fingered turned out to have an absolutely airtight alibi.
Yeah.
So after 5 days in custody, the police had to let Jeremy go, and he was allowed to post bail just for the burglary charge.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, he could have done it himself.
He could have. Why would he tell Julia?
I didn't believe
Julia
the hitman part. Why would he tell Julia that he hired a hitman?
Yeah.
Because she might not ever want to touch him again, yes, if she believes he killed two little boys.
Exactly, yeah. I could see that being true. Why would she pick that name, though? Why would he tell her the name? You do find that in some cases. We've seen this in past murder cases that we've looked into, that it's weird how when they try to pin it on someone, check if that person has an alibi or not. And frequently it does fall apart when that person does have an alibi. In this case, that person, the plumber, had a great alibi.
Yeah.
He had nothing to do with it. So either Jeremy's lying or she's lying at this point.
Yeah.
But Jeremy was Jeremy. So when he got out of prison, he tried to sell nude pictures of his dead sister to The Sun,
a sleazy
national tabloid. He had promised them that, quote, they'll show everything right down to the last detail, end quote.
Wow.
He wanted £20,000 for the pictures. He eventually backed out of selling them. He then promptly left the country for a trip to Saint-Tropez. He is an idiot. So, he's never going to do himself any favors. While he was away, the police found that Jeremy had broken into the farmhouse through a window while out on bail. So, after the murders, very recently. He said he had forgotten his keys, and he didn't get along very well with the housekeeper who lived very nearby. So he said, I broke in.
Yeah.
So no big deal. But that made them suspicious again. At this point, they absolutely believe he's the murderer. They just know that their case isn't airtight yet. When he came back from Saint-Tropez, it was September 29th, the police then rearrested Jeremy. Detective Mike Ainsley.
What, for breaking into the farmhouse?
For murder.
Oh, okay.
Detective Mike Ainsley had formally taken control of the investigation. He pored over David Bootfire's notes about the case, and he absolutely convinced himself that Jeremy was the killer. So he rearrested Jeremy for murder when he got back.
They still don't have good evidence.
Well, they have what they think is pretty strong evidence. Then they have Julia's story, which is, again, supposedly straight from the mouth of Jeremy. You'll see what else they have.
I mean, here that would not be enough.
And suddenly, the kind of story starts to change at this point. Suddenly, officers at the scene, when they were waiting for their siege of the farmhouse back on the day, they started recalling Jeremy's behavior as being odd.
Yeah.
And which it wasn't sort of described at the time. They said his slow driving on the way there now to them seemed kind of weird, like he was waiting for them to get there first. They thought his not calling 999 appeared very suspicious. Mm-hmm. He took the time to go find and look up the direct number to the police station. They thought that was weird. They thought that his crying and carrying on was feigned.
Yeah.
Like he was faking it.
That's what I was going to ask you at the time. Were there actual tears? Was, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. And also that maybe he was just fake throwing up. He was just like, I'm not really, just sort of retching, not actually throwing up. It's not clear if he really vomited out anything or not when he was supposedly doing that.
But unless he's a psychopath, you're going to have anxiety and feelings about what you just did.
For sure.
And you're going to be scared shitless because there's cops. Yeah. And what if they figure, you know what I mean? So
I imagine.
And none of that is unusual if he's guilty.
Are innocent, to be honest.
Exactly.
Others said he seemed oddly emotionless when the police returned Jeremy to his cottage after he'd been there all night and already knew that his whole family was dead. Mm-hmm. He made himself a bacon sandwich. To them, that was very weird.
Yeah. Yeah. Could you imagine eating after something like that? Yeah. No.
He made himself a bacon sandwich.
Coffee. You just made a thing like, yeah, sure.
I mean, if I'm hungry.
You're not. That's the point.
He had missed breakfast, Gary. I don't know. So they also did some tests on Sheila's hands.
Right.
And they showed hardly a hint of any residue that you'd expect from someone who had just fired a rifle over 20 times.
Yes.
Her feet also seemed oddly too clean. They thought, I mean, would she have walked around in blood or just, if she's walking around murdering people, her feet seemed clean. They looked like she's got out of the shower and gone to bed.
Yeah.
The red paint on the silencer, remember that the boot flowers had found for the police, matched that from the hearth at the farmhouse. And though DNA was still in its infancy and really wasn't a factor in this case, at least not initially, the police did find a drop of blood from the silencer and they said this matched Sheila's blood type. That was now absolutely a crucial, crucial piece of evidence. A forensic scientist said it was backsplatter, that this is the silencer, remember?
Okay.
That there was blood in the silencer and it was from, effectively, he was saying it's from Sheila, the bullet impacting Sheila.
Yeah. I mean, a good defense attorney could dispense with that evidence. Because, sure, the paint is from the mantle at the house. Doesn't say when it happened.
No, it doesn't say when it happened, but the implication is clear is that when they knew that Neville was battling with his attacker, and that attacker would have had that rifle, and if the silencer was on, it would have, knocked against and scratched against the mantle and gotten the blood, the paint.
It's not irrefutable evidence, but it is evidence.
It's highly suggestive that the silencer was on that rifle during the commission of the murders.
And somebody had to take it off and it couldn't have been Sheila.
Exactly. Well, it could have been, but it could have been if she could have taken it off. Why couldn't she? She could have taken it off to kill herself. Unless that's why the blood was more important than the paint. If the blood is in the silencer, that means the silencer was on when she was shot.
Yeah. But
that's
also
key.
But I mean, I wouldn't believe that she, because it would be like she laid down. Mm-hmm. And then realized, it's too long with the silencer. I got to take the silencer off.
Yeah.
If that happened, she'd take it off and plop it down on the floor next to her.
That's precisely what the police said.
She wouldn't go down. She wouldn't go put it back in the closet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what they said. So they thought there was strong evidence that the silencer had been on the gun. And it was logical that it'd be back in the gun cupboard if it hadn't. Yeah. So the blood inside the silencer or on this back splatter on the silencer to them is critical because, as you recall, she could not have committed suicide with that weapon with the silencer on. It was just too long and her fingers didn't reach.
Yeah.
So to them, that meant that Sheila had been murdered, not committed suicide. And this evidence to them meant Jeremy was in trouble. So they had found all those things out when they went and rearrested him.
Yeah.
So they had, in their mind, they felt they had more. Jeremy was held without bail at Norwich Prison. As the police drove him away from the station back in Essex, he had spotted a couple of friends and he kind of shot them a little smile. The media, someone got a picture of that.
Yeah.
And so the next day, there's Jeremy in the back of a police car smiling at, they don't know who, they can't say who, and it just looked terrible for him. So, I mean, honestly, even on his way to prison to be held and tried for mass murder, he still can't get out of his own way.
Yeah.
Now we're going to talk about the trial.
Okay.
The trial began on October 3rd, 1986, over a year later.
I imagine was this a huge story?
It was a massive story.
Was it a story here too? Did it become international?
Was.
I would think it would be too.
It was a story, but it was a blanketed coverage in England, in Britain.
Do you remember?
Vaguely.
Yeah.
I think I have a vague memory of this occurring, but not really much. The judge, Maurice Drake, presided over the Chelmsford Crown Court with Anthony Arledge prosecuting and Jeffrey Rivlin leading the defense. The first guy's name is Arledge, not Arledge. So the prosecution laid out their story. Here's the essentially the story. They said, here's what happened. When Jeremy left the farmhouse sometime before 10 p.m. the evening before the murders on August 6, 1985, mm-hmm. he had his scheme completely well planned out. He drove his car back to his cottage in Goldhanger. He waited there, I guess, you know, finalized his plotting, whatever. And then he began the trip back to the farmhouse in his mother's borrowed bicycle that he had taken from the house earlier just for the occasion. Uh-huh. Again, he in this now it's now the small hours of August 7th, and they have him sort of weaving through these little used farm lanes to avoid being seen. He then sneaked into the house through a bathroom window on the first floor, which presumably was not locked. And they had his admission, by the way, that he had known how to do that, again, since childhood.
Right.
He had probably snuck out and snuck back into the house through this bathroom window. He got the rifle with the silencer attached, and he crept up the staircase. I don't think they believed the whole story about the rabbits and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They just thought, you know, he went to the gun closet, and they had argued, and the boot flyers had at least one cousin had said, yeah, I saw it 2 weeks ago, and the silencer was on. So he went to the gun closet. He got the rifle with the silencer on, got some extra ammunition as well, and he then crept up the staircase where he first confronted June, his mother, in the master bedroom. He then shot Neville, his father, but Neville, as we know, was able to struggle downstairs, and he and Jeremy fought over the rifle. That's where the silencer got some paint on it as they fought near the hearth and got some, it scratched against the mantelpiece.
Yeah.
Jeremy then shot his father 4 more times in the kitchen, all of which were in the head, and he finally succumbed to his devastating injuries. Then it was Sheila's turn, and he woke her up and took her back to the master bedroom, where he made her shoot herself, and he last went into the children's bedroom and did what he did there. The gun he left in Sheila's hand, he put the Bible by her side, again, to frame her. She's mental. She's insane. This proves she did it. Those were kind of the finishing touches for his little frame job. That this, you know, this mad woman had done this terrible deed. And there was no phone call from Neville Bamber, of course, to his son saying, oh, Sheila's gone berserk. He just made that up. I think we just don't have any way to prove or disprove that. So they claiming there was no call. That was just part of the frame-up. Unfortunately, Jeremy then sort of went home on the bike, and he kind of took his time to get back there. Remember, he did that slow drive back after he'd called the police. He had called the local station, not 999. I guess their argument is that I'm not completely sure. I imagine, why not just call 999?
Yeah.
I don't know that answer. But he had left the phone off the hook of the farmhouse purposely, so they couldn't, you know, that's what they're saying. He had left the phone off the hook. Remember, we know the phone was off the hook.
Yeah.
The telecom operator was hearing, she could hear a dog bark in the background when she called. The line was open. And I imagine he did that to make it look like, oh yeah, my dad was talking to me and I don't know, something terrible happened to him, you know?
Yeah.
According to the timeline, Jeremy didn't call the police for about 25 minutes after calling Julia Mugford and telling her, you know, what my dad had just told me. That is kind of a long time, isn't it? So that attitude, like, okay, what's going on there? Why are you taking that long to call the police after your dad called you and said your sister has gone insane?
Yeah.
The prosecution said this was to delay the time before the police got to the scene.
And because why?
I'm not 100% clear. I don't know why he wants them to come to make sure they're dead. I don't know. They've all been shot multiple times.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. But they said they kind of had to say that he was waiting for the police to get there. I can understand why he would drive slow and wait and want the police to get there. The prosecution said that essentially he wanted to have an alibi. He didn't want to be on the scene when the police got there. It looked better for him if, oh, look, here I am just arriving just after you guys got here.
But in my mind, that's also suspicious.
It is.
Because if you got the phone call from your dad that your sister's gone berserk and you think something bad is happening at your family home where your mother and your nephews are, you're going to go there. You're not even going to wait for the police, right?
Yeah. I don't know.
I would.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, I suppose. Even if you know she has a weapon, though.
Sure.
I mean, he's a coward.
Of course.
Let's say that. He could admit to being a coward. Couldn't that be your defense, though? It's like, and I was afraid she'd shoot me, too. right?
Did he say his dad said she had a weapon?
Yes. Well, he knew he had left the weapon loaded on the kitchen table, so
yeah,
he could naturally suspect that for sure. I don't know. He said she's gone crazy and threatening us. I think he would have fairly thought that she did have the rifle. Yeah,
I mean, I don't know.
So it's not clear why they want him to have so much time elapse. I'm not completely sure, and I don't know how clear they made that. The prosecution focused really hard on the silencer. Sheila's blood on the silencer meant that the silencer was on the rifle when the bullets entered her throat and her chin, then next her chin.
It is the best piece of evidence, I think.
It is. If she had only discovered that she could not pull the trigger with the end of the silencer under her head, like you said, they said she would have just simply unscrewed it.
Yep.
And laid it next to her, right down beside her. She wouldn't have gone back downstairs to put it away in the gun cupboard.
Yeah.
So it could be found by the boot flowers 3 days later. But that wasn't all. The prosecution said that in fact, she knew little if anything about guns. And Jeremy had told the police, oh, she's gone target shooting. She knows guns. So, you know, he must have known she had the gun. Her father must have said that because he's telling the police, she's got a gun. I left the gun out in the kitchen and she knows how to use guns. So be careful, essentially, on the actual night of.
But I mean, if he's the murderer, then...
Yes. No, absolutely. So they're saying he's saying that to frame her. Yeah. In fact, the prosecution says she didn't know anything about guns. She'd never been really handled any guns in her life. And they also said, oh, look, and we think it's pretty clear that Neville had fought with his attacker, and he's a fit man, and she's just too small and too weak to have fought with him. And also they brought up she seemed oddly clean, including her hands and feet, to have done what Jeremy said she had done. They also claimed that she had not been having any suicidal thoughts and would never in a million years have harmed her children.
I thought she'd...
had made overt claims on at least two occasions that she might harm her children. She sure had.
Yeah.
Her psychiatrist, Dr. Ferguson, backed them up completely in those assertions, said no, she would have never harmed her children, and no, she hadn't been having any suicidal or psychotic thoughts lately. He went pretty all in on denying that she had it in her to kill her family at all. He said she'd never do it. She said her argument was with her mother, not anybody else. So she would have just killed her mother if she had done it. He made that assertion on the stand. They called forward ex-husband Colin Caffell, and he actually backed this up. He said that Sheila would never hurt the children. Pamela Bootflower, Sheila's aunt, and June's sister testified to what a gentle soul Sheila was. She didn't have an... They couldn't imagine she'd do something like this. Jeremy, on the other hand... They said there's not a violent bone in her body. And then Ann Eaton, her cousin, and also a boot flyer, she swore that Sheila knew nothing of guns. So they've got all these witnesses, one after the other, kind of backing up their story.
But also, typically, when mothers from like postpartum psychosis and stuff like that, when they do harm their children, they don't shoot them.
That's true.
I mean, and also, yeah, that's but, not, but it's not she, typically how women... commit violence. No,
but if she had, she had already killed her parents with that gun. So presumably, she would have used the same weapon. She wouldn't have, you know.
Yeah.
Presumably. I don't know if the defense brought that up or not.
Yeah.
Julia Mugford, the girlfriend, she stepped into the witness box and she performed beautifully. She told the whole story again. Very well done. She laid out all of Jeremy's the anger toward his family, how greedy he was. She had him saying, quote, "I'm not going to share my money with my sister!" Exclamation point. He told this to Julia, she said. When she and Jeremy had planned the robbery of the caravan site, and they had been wondering, like, is there on-site security? How are we going to deal with that? She said Jeremy told her, quote, "I could kill anybody. I can even kill my parents," end quote. So imagine the shocked gasp in the courtroom. So she kind of spun her yarn about him, you know, having been a long time planning to kill the family. And she did have to take back the story about the plumber. I don't know how she did it exactly. Yeah. She must have said he said that.
Yeah.
You know,
of course.
I imagine.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The prosecution, though, appears to have let that story about the plumber drop. And it was Jeremy who had always intended to do the deed. So I'm not sure, from what I've read, if the plumber thing made it into court or not, or if the defense brought that up.
Yeah, I mean, they should.
Now, Feasen said they did not, but I don't think, I don't think that was brought up by the prosecution or by Julia, the plumber part. They sort of let it go.
Yeah.
An obvious question is why Julia had not told anyone before the event, or, again, had not told anybody for a month after the event. Mm-hmm. And so the prosecution decided that they would head that up straight. The fuck does that mean? The prosecution decided to ask that question themselves. And she, of course, said what you'd expect her to say, that she was afraid of Jeremy.
Yeah,
she
of
lived
course.
In fear.
Yeah.
So she was weeping as she says, quote, "I was scared, just scared, what Jeremy might do," end quote. I hope I did a pretty good imitation of her.
Yeah. And then the beforehand is, I didn't think he was really going to do it.
Yes. I don't know. Like I said, he called her at 3 a.m. and said, "It's happening. It's going great." And she only later realized he meant murder.
Yeah.
Her story does have certain conveniences that remove her from looking as terrible as she could look about not telling anyone about this.
But I mean, it's happening and it's going great. Okay. Yeah. She can call 999, but
yeah, she could have.
It's not going to prevent it.
Yeah, no, but she could have called 911.
Yes.
And a month later, she could have done that the entire time. As he's telling her, she said in the days after, he told her everything, he gave her all the deets.
Oh,
and she never told a soul for a month.
Yeah.
3 days after that, he broke up with her. So the defense did push back.
Did she confirm that he did break up with her?
I don't know.
Okay, yeah.
The defense did push back. They pushed Julia, wondering how she could continue to be intimate for a month with a man she knew had committed one of the most heinous crimes in modern British history, just like you said. It's like, okay, you know, how could you let this monster, you know what he did, two little kids, you let him touch you? And she answered, quote, "This was the only reason I went to the police, not because I felt he was slipping away from me, but because I could not cope with such a hideous thing," end quote. So a month, and then she finally couldn't cope with it any longer. The core argument for the defense was, beyond Julia's testimony being false, was that there just wasn't any positive evidence that Jeremy had anything to do with killing his parents and his sister and his nephews. No one had seen him on the bicycle. No one had seen him enter or exit the farmhouse. He had absolutely no physical signs of battling with his father either, even though Sheila did not, he did not either. He had no scratches, nothing like that whatsoever. The police found no like bloodstained clothes anywhere when they did search his house. You're right. It's possible he could have gotten rid of them in the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he also did not have any gunpowder on his hands either. Any kind of residue. Now,
did they test his hands that night?
Not that night.
Oh
no.
Okay. Then
I don't know. I don't know when, but no, I know.
Again, they test him a month later.
They were under the assumption from pretty much the get go that this was a murder suicide. Contrary to the prosecution's forensic scientist who told the jury that the blood sample in the silencers was for sure Sheila's, the defense pointed out, hey, it's just a blood type match. That's all we can do. It's nothing more. And even that match, they argued, the defense did, that it was uncertain. It wasn't even clear it was Sheila's blood type. The prosecution forensic guy said, no, it's Sheila's blood.
Yeah.
So there's a pretty big discrepancy there. Hmm.
Yeah, I don't think they can really tell for sure that
it's
hers.
They could just do blood type then.
But also, what is that rifle used for, and why would there be blood on it anyway?
No, blood in the silencer. Remember, the blood in the silencer is everything in this case.
But, and that silencer is used on this rifle, which, why do they have a silencer?
Probably because they did shoot around the farmhouse, and there were other, I mean, not too far away, I don't know, nice. They also didn't have loud parties. I don't know, Carrie. They
had a silencer.
They for sure had a silencer.
I mean, silencers are suspicious, right? Isn't it hard?
Not really.
You can't just go buy a silencer, can you?
In 1985? I don't know.
Yeah.
In England, I wouldn't think so. I don't know.
I know.
I don't
that
know.
Part seems weird.
That does seem weird.
To me.
It was never brought up as weird, though.
But also, they're not typically using that gun for purposes where there's going to be human blood. And so I would think in 1985, it's not rabbit blood. It's not cow blood. It's not pig blood.
It's human blood, and it's Sheila's blood type.
Exactly.
Is what they said.
So,
Yeah. So that was, and again, just being able to convince the jury that silencer was on was second to Julia's story, the most important part of the case.
Yeah.
So the defense went after Julia's story as well. They said it was a wholesale lie, as you expect them to say. They said that Jeremy actually had been getting along pretty well with his parents lately, that everybody who saw him said he'd acted normally the night of the killings. And they explained that, he drove slowly to the farmhouse because he was afraid of what he might find. He kind of wanted the police to be there first. He was scared.
Yeah.
He had not called 999 because he had no reason to think that anything violent had happened yet. he thought, okay, she's going through one of her episodes. She had episodes. She was having one of her episodes, and it was just sort of Sheila acting crazy again.
That's having playing at both sides.
It is. Yes, it is.
You don't call 911 because you don't really know that it's that an emergency, yet you're afraid to go there without the police there. Yeah. So, no.
That's a little bit contradictory.
Very contradictory.
And also, basically, he's saying that, you know, Sheila has a gun, but I don't think she's going to be, I didn't have any reason to think she's going to be violent and use that gun. It was just Sheila being Sheila. And also, he said that we're very private people. He didn't want to,
Then you go there and you try to help talk Sheila out of her tizzy or whatever.
He did not.
He went there,
made sure the police were there first, and then went with
him. He's trying to have it both ways, and you can't.
Okay.
It's inconsistent, and your behavior doesn't match.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
You're strong and forceful, and I might say listener's angry opinion. And besides, the defense said the police had the obvious killer all along. It was Sheila. So they detailed how her mental episodes and things like that, her anger and loathing of her mother, etc. And they said, look, she had gone target shooting. She knew something about guns. She had a proven history of mental instability. She had this huge antagonism towards her mother, and she had threatened the family and said that she was capable of killing her children. So they kind of contradicted what Dr. Ferguson had said.
Yeah.
She had told her psychiatrist she had contemplated murdering her children. I just said that. Hold on a second.
But okay, here's the thing. I don't know what the rules of evidence are there. The defense lawyers can't say that.
I don't know.
That's not evidence.
Yeah. Well, I know they brought up her mental instability. I don't know how much detail that was done in, to be honest with you. I don't know able to say that.
Jeremy, I
imagine, did not ever take the stand. I never read that he did, so I don't think he did.
Yeah, so who is actually saying that?
Not Dr. Ferguson.
I know. So that's interesting. I wonder how it works
in
England. But
there's a record of her having said that.
Yeah.
So maybe the public records? I don't know.
What public records?
Yeah, they weren't public. They'd be private. Yeah. One of them, I'd have to go back to part one, but one of them I thought was public, that she'd called it in and said, I think I might hurt my kids.
Oh,
I think she did do that one time. The other time was to the doctor.
Yeah.
So... The defense also said that Neville and June had recently broached the subject of getting the kids into foster care, and that this was kind of a triggering thing for Sheila. She's like, all I have is my children, even though she thought they were evil, and she could make them do evil.
Yeah.
She was very fragile, they said. One witness, who was a close friend of Sheila's, had talked about how she'd been acting actually very erratically and had recently had a breakdown in March of that year, which we talked about.
Uh-huh.
This friend said that she had been acting—
So 5 months earlier.
Yes. But she had been acting paranoid. She had talking about the God and the devil. And he also, this friend said that, and she was really just was vituperative about her mom. She really had a problem with her mom. Essentially, they kind of painted this picture of she's a powder keg ready to explode. And that night, Jeremy stupidly had left in the kitchen the means for her to act on her insanity. And she had. That was essentially the counter for the defense. So the case went to the jury, 7 men and 5 women. It was British legal custom for the judge to sum up the case for the jury. That's been true for a very long time. The judge basically said, okay, here's what you just heard.
Okay.
And Judge Drake took this opportunity to put his finger very firmly on the scale, or really his whole hand and some upper body weight. Judge Drake, admitted that Sheila was not a stable woman, but he said that was, quote, certainly no evidence, quote, end quote, of her being out of control that night.
He's correct.
He thought it unlikely she could have fought with her far larger father.
Oh, he's allowed to make
He's allowed to say anything he damn well wants.
Wow.
He said that her hands and feet were pristine, which made it, quote, inconceivable that she was the killer. And he said he took up the silencer. He said the red paint told him, Judge Drake, that the silencer must have been on the rifle and got there when the killer wrestled with Neville against the mantelpiece. When the jury sent out a question asking if the blood on the silencer was, quote, a perfect match, unquote, for Sheila's, Judge Drake's answer was that it did not match anyone else. And he told him that the blood was, quote, overwhelmingly likely, end quote, to be Sheila's blood.
Yeah. Well, you know what, also because she's adopted, it's could be very likely that she has a completely different blood type.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. For sure.
In this house, if mm-hmm. it was only on blood type, it could be five people's.
Exactly. The adoption thing does make the blood typing more interesting. The judge finally told the jury that Julia Mugford's testimony alone was enough to convict.
Wow.
So it wasn't just a finger.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a hand.
Yeah.
I think he stood on the scale.
That seems pretty improper.
Yeah. The jury found for conviction 10-2, the minimum allowed for conviction in England.
Oh, okay.
As you know, unanimity in jury trials, in my opinion, is the most idiotic thing on the planet Earth.
Yeah.
One dumbass can completely mm-hmm. ruin. So England allows a 10-2 to convict, which I think is completely logical.
Yeah, I do too.
Jeremy sat at the defense table just stunned, speechless. He just always assumed. He thought, this is absurd. They're never going to convict me. He was absolutely floored by the verdict. Judge Drake told Jeremy his act was, quote, was evil, almost beyond belief, end quote, and he sentenced him to life in prison. Bootflower clan leader Robert, who, by the way, had the same blood type as Sheila and had been in possession of the gun for several days, as we know, he gave this little impromptu speech outside of the courtroom about, like, what a great girl Sheila was. He thanked the police. It's like a real victory speech right outside, right after it occurred. And Eaton, his daughter, was also instrumental in getting Jeremy convicted, would write in her diary that, quote, we cried with absolute relief, all caps, end quote. If you do want to go deep into the legal machinations and the hearings and the appeals that Jeremy has made in the years since and his lawyers and all those things, then I really, you should read that New Yorker article by Heidi Blake. It's an exceptional article. It goes in. I'm not going to go into that here.
Yeah.
I will suffice it to say that Jeremy's team has made many points of order and brought forward evidence and new analysis that indicate that the investigation was pretty shoddy, that the evidence was handled very poorly.
Yeah.
And that there was a certain bias among both the police and obviously Judge Maurice Drake. And they've appealed based on those grounds in the years since.
Was there any allegation of collusion between the Bootflowers and the girlfriend?
Because, that's a great question.
I mean, you'd have to have that.
You wouldn't have to have that. She could have.
Yeah, you would.
We're going to talk about that in part three.
Because some of her. Oh, okay. Details matched.
Details match.
Yeah.
But the story was already out there to the police before she made her story, before she testified to the police a month later.
Yeah.
So the police knew everything that the Bootflowers were alleging before Julia. You're right. It could have come that way, but it could have come from the police, or it could have been the whole truth and nothing but the truth. So help her God. So again, read Heidi Blake's article if you want to get into all that. There's a big part of her article is about what the years since the verdict.
Yeah.
But suffice it to say that the British appeals system is atrocious. It is far more concerned with upholding the reputation of British law enforcement than it is in getting anywhere near close to actual justice. It's the same story as ours. It's even worse. It's actually worse. It's almost impossible to get anything changed.
Well, I mean, ours is patterned after theirs, so.
Yeah, no. So we're going to end this by just sort of summing up the case against Jeremy, looking at it with a more critical eye. Here's the best points that the prosecution made. And we'll go through it pretty quickly. But then part three, we'll talk at some length, the case in favor of Jeremy being innocent and try to kind of weigh the two together and then sum it up at the end of part three. So let's end with the case against Jeremy. So let's take the next step now. We can, hold on. Okay. First, let's acknowledge that Jeremy was an asshole.
Yeah.
He was arrogant. He was pompous. He was sleazy. He was an actual criminal.
Yeah.
He had committed that break-in at the caravan site. He was greedy. He was kind of lazy. And the Bootflowers would say he was kind of too lazy to support his excessive taste, and he wanted to live easy on his parents' wealth.
Uh-huh.
Instead of grieving in the brutal aftermath of his entire family being slaughtered, he took trips to Saint-Tropez, to Amsterdam, by the way, to buy a weed.
Yep.
He tried to sell nude pictures of his sister to a tabloid. Jeremy Bamber seems hardly worth saving or even, looking at whether he might have been innocent. But as they say, none of those things make him a murderer.
Yep.
We just might wish they did. But the prosecution did score some strong points in pointing out how pristine Sheila was. Let's take that first. Remember, there's no signs of battle. She has perfectly clean feet. There's little, if any, signs on her on her hands of firing a weapon, and the blood on her nightgown. There was a little blood on her nightgown, but it was limited. And the forensic folks said that it was her blood, not any of her supposed victims.
Yeah.
So where was their blood? She had shot them at close range.
Yeah.
Jeremy's lawyers would point out that the trial and appeals that in the trial and in later appeals that Sheila could have bathed after she had murdered her last victim and before she killed herself, possibly, they thought.
Why?
There is this kind of ritualized behavior with some psychoses, and it's not unusual, especially when the psychoses are kind of religious based. There actually is some evidence that you do these ritualized behaviors, and some of which can involve bathing. At least that's what they've argued.
Sure.
And it is true that her you know, psychosis did have these strong religious undertones to them. So, but so what? If so, where was the bloodstained nightgown that she removed or whatever she's wearing?
Exactly. Yeah.
The boot flyers did find bloodied panties, underwear soaking in water in a bathroom later on. And they interpret that as that she was having her period.
I was going to say, that happened, you know.
That's exactly what they said. So,
that's been true in our house, and nobody here committed murder.
Could she have burned the bloody nightgown or something like that? Or did it conveniently disappear, you know, by someone, interested parties, namely the police? Uh-huh. If not, you know, it's a strike against Jeremy for sure. Then there is a lot about the .22 Anschutz rifle that was the murder weapon, the 10-shot magazine, right? That you remember? So first, let's start with the rabbits. You hear rabbits and you, what, load up? Your rifle is 22 is not a very powerful rifle, but still you thought, I'll go out and shoot some rabbits here as I'm enjoying a nice evening with my family who I don't see, especially my sister and my nephews. That seems weird. And then you leave a loaded rifle in the kitchen when you leave, knowing your sister has some serious issues. I mean, again, never imagine that she's going to do
something like that. Or that there are children in the house.
That's true. Yeah.
Who could wake up before their parents and. Yeah. Come downstairs in the morning.
It's a strange, even if Sheila had shown no signs of becoming unhinged by the time he left, it's still a very strange thing to do.
Yes.
There was the loading of the rifle as well. I kind of hinted at that in part one. If the magazine was left fully loaded with 10 shots, it still means that Sheila would have had to reload it twice more to account for the number of shots fired.
Yeah.
One forensic specialist said he would have expected more lead on her hands. But again, they would argue she could have washed her hands or bathed. She had just as much opportunity as Jeremy did.
Yeah.
And the prosecution also said, well, okay, she's in a nightgown, which they found her in a nightgown. How did she carry the bullets around, the extra ammunition? So, you know, they're saying no, that she wasn't because she didn't do it. Maybe, I don't know, she had a pockets on a bathrobe or something like that, the defense might say. But it's also, as I again hinted to, it's difficult to get those last cartridge or two into that kind of the magazine for that Anschutz. It takes some strength.
Yeah.
So was Sheila strong enough to do that? You know, the counter to that is though that she shouldn't have to be. No, she could have loaded 8 and not done the last one or two. That's hard. And you still get 10 plus 8 plus 8. That's more than the shots that were fired. So
it
that kind of cuts both ways. But what about the silencer? If it was on the rifle, then Sheila could not have killed herself with it. She's not the perp. Would Sheila have put that silencer back in the gun cover? A lot of people think no, but we'll never know. So let's take a look at that blood in the silencer, though. That's a strong, strong point for the prosecution. Was it really her blood? We just won't know for sure. Yeah. But if it was...
But based on what the judge said... It can't have been somebody else's blood in that house.
Yes. Well, yeah.
So that's pretty meaningful.
That's true. I mean, we could say that maybe he only realized after he shot her and he, like Jeremy puts the gun in her hands and then he realizes. Because, you know, you'd think, wouldn't he be smart enough if he staged a suicide to know that she couldn't have used the silencer so he'd take it off and he wouldn't have used it so there wouldn't be the blood on it, right?
Yeah.
You would argue. But it's possible that he did shoot her with the silencer, which the forensic evidence from the prosecution said that he did.
Yeah.
And then he realized, like, maybe when he's putting it on her chest and putting it in her hands, he's going, oh, shit. And then he takes the silencer off. Why wouldn't he also have just laid it on the ground? I don't know. But for some reason, the prosecution argues that he put it back in the gun cupboard. And at the very least, in favor of the prosecution, it does seem weird that Sheila would have not just put it on the ground.
Yeah. And also, why didn't he clean it?
That's true, too. Yeah. That is weird.
Or maybe he did wipe it down. Maybe it had more blood on it.
Maybe
he wiped it down and it just didn't get it.
But he also missed the paint. Eh.
Well, the paint is.
Yeah. It is weird that he wouldn't.
Probably wouldn't be easily wipeable.
I guess. But why would you leave it there at all?
Yeah.
Why would you not just get rid of it?
Yeah. Yeah.
If you've realized enough that you have to take it off, you don't leave it in the gun cupboard.
Well, because he knows other people know that it exists.
So. So what?
It probably never comes up. Yeah,
exactly. Because
yeah,
there's never any blood found on it to point the finger at you.
Well, I mean, nobody accused him of being the smartest.
No, that's true.
Guy in the world, did they?
Yeah. And then, of course, is the part about her fighting with her father. That's unusual. She wasn't that strong.
Yeah.
Now we get to what is by far the best evidence against Jeremy and our something that's very damning. Is why did he look up the police station number after he called his father had called and said all hell's breaking loose in the house? That's very strange.
Yep.
Why did it take so long before he called even the police station, let alone 999? You think he called 999 immediately?
Yes.
Right away, 10 seconds later. Why is he calling Julia Mugford to say, hey, my dad just called and something crazy is happening? Why call at all? It's 3 in the morning.
It would be more believable for him not to call at all and just race right over there.
Yeah. For sure.
Because he's closer than the police are.
You still call the police.
Well,
I think.
Sure, but I think there are instances where a lot of men wouldn't.
Yeah, you're right.
They're going to run over there thinking, you know, I'm going to save the day or I can help.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times you don't want the police involved in a family situation, right?
Yeah. And but remember also, he didn't get along with Sheila. He was the last person. He and his mom were the worst people to try to calm things down.
Yeah.
And again, the time it took him to get over to the house is a little suspicious. It seems like he is kind of set up an alibi there. You know, scandal or not, he knew that Sheila had access to the rifle because he left it out.
Right.
And he should have acted with much more urgency.
That would be an argument for why you would call 999. Yeah. I left that loaded rifle.
Jeremy told the police under questioning that he was not in a major hurry because he thought it would not make a difference how soon they got to the farmhouse. I don't know what that means. That's what he said.
Because they're already dead.
That's you'd think. It almost implies that he knew they were dead.
Yes.
It's a very strange thing to have said.
If he said that,
yeah. So who knows? But, you know, he shouldn't have known that, obviously. He really said he didn't really think Sheila was violent until he found out she was. He did tell the police that she was, quote, a nutter.
Yeah.
But, you know, he seemed baffled by what they said she did on that night.
Yeah.
There are a few items other than the stuff. So that's the stuff kind of really strongly, clearly in favor of Jeremy being guilty. There's some things that kind of cut both ways. They're a little bit ambiguous as to their implications. One is the prosecution made much of Jeremy driving so slowly to the farmhouse and then alerting them. And they had Ann Eaton of the Bootfire family testify that he was normally a very speedy driver, which seems a little bit overdoing it there a little bit. Was Jeremy trying to make sure they saw him arrive? I don't know. Or was he just afraid of what he's going to find out? So that could cut both ways. I'm not sure what the implication of that is. It could be him setting up an alibi. It could be him just being scared. Again, you think, most men would do this. Maybe he's not most men and he was scared.
Okay, but that doesn't match his reasoning for not calling 999.
That's true. Think of those as two separate things, though.
Well, but they're not.
They are kind of separate things.
No, they're not.
Yeah, they are. Him going over there slowly is potentially a separate thing than just taking too long to call 999. Calling 999 doesn't have anything to do with what he's afraid when he got there.
I'm not saying taking too long to call 999. Oh. The fact that he didn't call 999, he called a non-emergency number.
Yes.
He didn't think it was that dire of a circumstance at that point.
Okay. Yeah, you could argue that, but again, maybe he's not thinking clearly. A lot of people don't think clearly in this kind of a situation. The blood and paint on the Selinger that we know was key to the prosecution is a little bit more problematic than you might think.
Mm-hmm.
There does seem to have been blood on the Selinger. There was possibly red paint, which might have come from the hearth and the fight for the weapon, but that's all just a suggestion.
Yeah.
Especially that paint thing. We don't know. They just sort of, that's speculation again.
Well, and I agree, because you can't say when that happened either. It makes sense that it could have happened that night. So I wouldn't use that to convict him.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
There's also some questions about how many calls were made to the police. It's not clear. It's weird. They didn't keep really good records. There's Jeremy that called the police at 3:26 in the morning. And there's a clear log about this from Constable Michael West that said that. The problem was he said it was at 3:36 and not 3:26. And it's pretty clear it was at 3:26 because he, after the taking the call and writing it down, he told a civilian dispatcher, sent a car to the farmhouse, the White House farmhouse, and that car left, Charlie Alpha 5, that car left at 3:35 a.m. So it couldn't have left, been dispatched a minute before the call. So he probably just got the time wrong. But the prosecution said that that was the only call. The defense would say that no, there was a second call from Neville directly to the police station. And there was a lot of confusion. There might have been a call from Neville. There might have been not just one call, but two calls, one from Jeremy to the police and one from Neville to the police saying there's trouble here. And we just don't know. The records are so poorly kept or have been destroyed that we're not positive there wasn't a second phone call.
Well, what time was the Neville phone call?
We don't know. Sometime around here, I'll tell you. So the civilian dispatcher, his name is Micah Bonnet, he began what's called a radio log, which is kind of an accounting of any communication about this new incident. The defense contended that there were two calls on August 7th, and that the I'll tell you what this first one said. It read, Mr. Bamber, White House Farm, Tallis Hunt Darcy, daughter Sheila Bamber, age 26 years, has got hold of one of my guns. Has got hold of one of my guns. That makes it sound as if the call came directly from Neville, doesn't it? It does to me. It's an audible to write that if it didn't.
You want me to explain that one?
No.
Okay.
Then it adds, quote, message passed to CD by the son of, which I think means dispatch, but the son of Mr. Bamber after phone went dead. That seems to be referring to Jeremy's call, not recording Jeremy's call.
Yeah.
Now, that, I mean, that those two things combined are, to me, at least indicate there potentially was a second call directly from Neville. Now go ahead, tell me why that's not true, or explain that.
No, I'm not saying it's not true. This would make Jeremy even a little bit more devious because he could have made that phone call
and pretended to be his dad.
Interesting. To make his story more plausible,
he just had to put on that old gruff English. Hello. Oh, Sheila is crazy. She's got my gun. That's the worst accent ever.
They're not recording the calls, right? Yeah, well, clearly.
You're right.
So,
yeah, I don't know. So, but and the defense contends that there were two calls, and it gets even more confused by the time notations that made things seem weirder. So we don't know. But certainly Jeremy claims his father stopped talking and claims to have tried to call back and heard noises because the line was still open.
Yeah.
Which indicated his dad had not hung up the phone, but had let it fall for some reason. And the British Telecom backed this up, but we just don't know. And that's the core of it. So that's the evidence we have in favor of Jeremy being guilty. A little bit of evidence that kind of cuts potentially both ways. Mm-hmm. Part three, we will go through at some length the argument that Jeremy may not have been the murderer and it may actually have been Sheila indeed. And then we'll sort of wrap it up after that. So that's it. Thank you for listening. Hopefully, I say enjoyed, I don't mean that. Hopefully you found this interesting and intriguing. It is a fascinating case despite being a horrific case.
Yeah.
And we'll end it up.
I have a quick question.
Yes.
Is Jeremy still alive?
Yes, he is.
Okay. I'm not going to ask you where he is right now.
You don't have to. Because like in the 48 hours, they show them in like a button-up shirt. And then they do a pan back and he has the orange jumpsuit right beneath the button-up shirt. So, okay. We can talk about that. You can ask that question after part three at the end there when we wrap it up.
Yep.
Until then.
Thanks for listening. Bye.